Hello, I'm Andy Burnham, and you're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. This week we visit the Amberley Chalk Pit Industrial Museum in Sussex. There's a review of what looks like the last Free Radio Quarterly, how the planners allocate space on the FM band, there's a look at American college radio, and Britain's bosses discover corporate television via satellite, more about digital cinema sound, and more complaints about cricket on Radio 3. That, along with your letters, is Sparks this week, for a Monday and Tuesday on Radio Facts 3910 6205 and 12255.
Listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. I'm Andy Burnham, and me and Miss Ruth have come to the Amberley Chalk Pit Museum in the heart of West Sussex. It's set in a beautiful chalk pit, and we've brought our picnic. And so rather than talk to you lot, I'm going to eat my yoghurt. Mmm, delicious. Oh dear, we've missed another train. There's steam trains to see here. There's a vintage bus gone past with open top. We'll be going on that later on. There's also a vintage wireless exhibition and a working amateur radio station, so I'm told. And lime kilns to see, brickyard, a tram shelter, and an electrical exhibition, some of which we'll be visiting in a few minutes.
I like the telephone box with the little telephone exchange. I'm going in.
Oh, they've got an old-fashioned. They've got a thing with an A button and a B button. I could never remember what these did. Unfortunately, it seems to be shut. Let's go in the telephone exchange instead. Good grief. It's a little tiny Strowger with lots of batteries. and the whirling arms that go around and connect everybody up.
I think it's a lovely little exchange. Really nice.
It's not something you'd normally see. And look what I've found. They've left within reach some post office engineering department engineering instructions. They've got the complete manuals how to maintain all this old electric Meccano stuff. Let's have a look. Automatic exchange mechanisms, wipers and banks, special maintenance information, PO type 2 uni selectors. A number of circuits developed recently incorporate 10 and 12 level uni selectors. Apart from four features, self-feed brushes, wiper locating screw and clamp, facilities for wiper spindle lubrication and speed of running, these uni selectors are similar in all respects to the 3, 8 and 10 level versions. Blah blah blah, that's for official use only. There's no date on that. There's also some diagrams as how to maintain your uni selectors. Fascinating. And you see each of these little dials?
Yeah.
Each with a number on, 216, 217.
Yeah.
What they'll do is they used to clock up and record how much each person had used on their phone bill. And when it came to read your phone bill, the engineer would go and look at, say, number 219 is 4551, and they'd work out how much you'd used your telephone.
Yeah.
These days it's all done on computer, well, mostly, unless you live in somewhere out in the middle of nowhere like Trevor, in which case it's probably working on something exactly like this still. Oh, we found some uni selectors you can play with. Pick up the phone then, Ruth.
Right.
And then dial 00. Introduced in 1936. Local calls could be dialed direct by inserting 4 pence. If the called number answered, speech could take place after pressing button A, which deposited the coins in the cash box below the mechanism. If no answer was obtained, you could get your money back by pressing B, which returned the coins by way of the refund chute. Here comes the train. Hope we don't miss it this time.
then, Ed. That's a gypsy caravan.
1927 Albion PM728 single deck bus.
The red car.
The old fashioned tractor.
E.C. Gray, pastry cook and confectioner, baker. Lovely.
I told you the pottery
little
was that
chariot.
Way. Well, shall we look? Go down and see what we can find down here. We'll go to the pottery later. Here's the bus.
On a double decker.
It's nice. The bus waited for us and we're up on the top deck.
Marvellous views all around.
Did you know James Bond's View to a Kill was filmed here?
No.
It's a scene with an airship, I remember it, and them flying into a railway tunnel, I think. It's just over there.
Oh, right.
Oh, we're going back the way we came. This is going to end up right back where we started, you know, Ruth. Never mind, we'll have to get the train back again, won't we? Another excuse to go on it. Oh, the bus garage is surprising. Should we get off then?
Is he stopping?
Yeah. Old-fashioned petrol pumps. 11 pence a pint, Shell motor oil, this one. One and three a gallon petrol.
And then we made it to the vintage wireless exhibition.
Telegraph, and a look at some old radio sets. Leyden jars, World War One and Two. And crystal and valve sets, including some very old BBC headphones. And onto the 1920s, and some radio 1 shilling blueprints. J. Cam's ELF 3-valve portable, the Limit All Wave 4, the Tutor 3, and the ST Super, all from the 1920s. There's a wonderful collection of old valves arranged in a star shape, dating from 1915, some very early ones, to 1965. Quite a few I recognise, and oh look, an 813, in fact two. I wonder if this cabinet opens and pinch some. So there's also a great big one in the corner that's got copper cooling tubes about a foot long.
Okay, they go far off over the next one of 59 also. Thank you, Charlie.
Goes for our room two, Charlie Papa Mike.
That's 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Oh, just tell us, one of those in the museum. I wonder if there's any others I recognise. Look, Ruth, look, there's up there, the beige one and the brown one.
Oh,
the beige one's like ours.
Yeah, that's right.
It's got a volume and a tune on it, which ours hasn't. There's hundreds of old gramophones and radiograms as well. TV set with a big magnifying glass in front. And a leak tuner with a leak amplifier, another thing that's familiar from the Radiofax transmitter. More bits of history. Oh, look, sitting on top of it, a Sinclair IC10 10 watt integrated circuit amplifier, complete with applications manual. These round ones are very valuable.
Yeah.
They're sort of art deco.
Yes, I know from the design shape. Oh, look at this, it's lovely, isn't it? I want to stay here. This is the 20s kitchen. The kitchen and scullery, which do not represent a particular dwelling, but shows a country cottage scene of the early 1920s.
And there's a roaring fire in there. This is part of the domestic equipment exhibition, and there's some old ovens. Oh no, it's a fridge. What fun. And then just come around here and have a look at one of the others. One of the nice things about this museum is it's not all behind bars. When we were earlier in the telephone box looking at all the GPO manuals, and you can have a go with the old fridges. This is a what makes this a Lek, probably 1950s. Next door there's an Electrolux and another Lek. Have a look in this one. All remarkably clean. And this one's the Raplin handmade ice making machine, which makes ice, ice cream and iced wine. And it's got a huge cooling heat exchanger thing on the top, which is a spiral tube. Great big thing. And inside there's some plastic looking ice cream. Walking along the nature trail over the stile.
Yes dear.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax as ever, 6205 3910 and 12255. And we're here almost live at the Amberley Chalk Pits Museum, which is in West Sussex. It's just outside Arundel. If you're coming from the London area, you drive down the A29 and it's signposted. And it's an industrial museum, including such things as a lime kiln, working locomotive sheds. You can go up and down on the choo-choo train as many times as you like for nothing once you've paid to get in. And there's a bus garage with an old-fashioned bus that runs up and down. There's a working pottery, concrete exhibition, an electrical exhibition, which we'll have to go to in a minute, the wireless exhibition, which is marvellous, thoroughly recommended, and the display of domestic equipment, and a very tiring nature trail. Back on the bus again.
Yep.
Hand start bus, you know, you have to crank it by hand.
Oh God.
Beauty.
Electromedical generator. Treatment from hand generators was thought to be particularly good for nervous diseases and was fashionable for a long period from the 1840s until the 1920s. Expert opinion was divided on their merits. According to one, such instruments were an instrument of torture to the patient, more fitted to the amusement of the strong on the fairgrounds than for use upon an invalid.
And the Vio-Ray apparatus in 1925.
In use, the apparatus is switched on and the glass electrode held close to the area to be treated. A high-frequency current passes through the evacuated glass tube and jumps in a series of tiny sparks onto the skin of the patient. The violet glow produced by the discharge inside the glass tube gives the apparatus its name.
Off goes the train again. And hidden away down a leafy little lane should be the lime kilns. And this is the concrete exhibition, which is very quiet, with the history of concrete making from the Egyptians and the Romans, and then back when it was rediscovered in about 1750, and on through to a model of the Sydney Opera House. Stationary engine, a diesel engine, I think.
thing. So why on earth should I moan? Cause when I get you alone, you know I feel okay. When I'm home, everything seems to be right. When I'm home, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard
Radio 4 looked at the threat to privatisation or close down of BBC Radio 1. In the report, Atlantic 252 got a mention.
A commercial Radio 1, whether sold off or run by the BBC with advertisements, would be highly attractive to advertisers. But existing commercial stations are horrified by the thought.
Welcome to Atlantic 252, the fastest growing radio station in the UK.
Broadcast from Ireland, Atlantic 252 reaches most of the UK and claims 5 million listeners. Manager Travis Baxter says if Radio 1 took advertising, it would swamp the commercial stations.
I think an organisation with the substantial brand image the BBC has and its hugely deep pockets would so distort the marketplace that you could end up with a David and Goliath situation. And I think in the short term it would devastate the commercial sector and massively reduce the potential developing choice that's coming out of the newly licensed radio services.
Such dilemmas lie at the heart of the public debate about the future of the BBC. Belanovsky says the BBC does too much.
Certainly in the UK, our radio sector is highly underdeveloped because of the public service dominance of the BBC. Local independent radio has been sort of stifled to permit the BBC to have four national, five national channels, regional, local. It's overexpanded in that area.
Others argue that if it abandoned its popular services, the BBC would cater only for minorities and find it harder to justify the licence fee. In any case, says Johnny Beerling, Radio 1 isn't just a pop station.
We're just currently doing a programme about young people's feelings, coping with depression, violence in the home, suicide and so on. Later on this year, a major project on racism and how that affects young people. Now, all these sorts of things, and new comedy too, is the sort of thing that we do on Radio 1 that isn't done by any other popular music radio station.
Other BBC networks are also under debate. Radio 3's facing a commercial competitor and changing its schedules, prompting letters of complaint, firmly denied, that it's going down market. There's a question mark over the new Radio 5 and suggestions of a radio news network. 1967 saw the birth not just of Radio 1, but Radios 2, 3 and 4 as well. 25 years on, an equally radical shake-up may be in prospect.
Torrin Douglas on the Today programme.
And a couple of short items from Audio Media magazine. And this refers to something that I heard a few weeks ago in the London area. Fostech UK has been supporting the efforts of XFM, London's new experimental 24-hour indie radio station, by loaning the principal equipment for the station's production studio. XFM was scheduled to broadcast alternative and independent music for 4 weeks, starting the 13th of April, and indeed it did.
The aim of the station, broadcast to Camden and Islington in North London on 101.2 FM, is to prove to the radio authority that the station is desperately needed, says Sammy Jacob, co-director of XFM. XFM is partly sponsored by the New Musical Express, which feels that a station of this nature has been long needed and will have great appeal for its readers. The directors, Chris Parry, founder of Fiction and Desire Records, and Sammy Jacobs, promoter of indie bands such as Carter and Manic Street Preachers, plan to use the anticipated public success of XFM as a campaigning platform for a permanent London-wide service. XFM's production studio was equipped with a Fostek 2412 24-channel mixing console, a G16F half-inch 16-track tape machine, an E2 two-track machine and a D20 timecode DAT recorder. Further equipment had been generously donated by other manufacturers, including Yamaha outboard gear, Sennheiser mics and headphones, JBL monitors and amplifier, and Harman hi-fi equipment. Well, I picked up this XFM a few weeks ago, as you may have heard me mention. It was very weak in my area, but I could listen to it, and generally the programmes were very good. And different sort of music that I don't think is catered for very well on British radio. And also, low-cost rival to Roland Space Sound and Q-Sound launched. Yes, it's another one, called OM, or maybe that's This British development is being described as a realistically priced 3D sound processing system in a 3U rack mounting case. It's been developed by Perfect Pitch Music Limited, a young company of psychologists and electronic design engineers based in Surrey. As with other 3D sound processing systems, OM provides the capability of placing sounds in a stereo mix so that they sound as if they originate outside the area between the two loudspeakers. OM can control two channels of 180-degree continuous pan in one arc to the front of the listener and two channels of 300-degree pan that extends from the left-hand loudspeaker to the right-hand loudspeaker in a continuous arc to the rear of the stereo listening position. The unit is ideally integrated into a mixer system with up to four auxiliary sends so that the treated signal returns to the mixer as a stereo pair, either as a stereo effects return or as two hard-panned matched mono channels. To ease integration with smaller setups, each of the four OM channels has its own level control before it feeds the internal 3D stereo bus. In this way, the unit may be used as an effect submixer. Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club has already used the system for a 3D stereo radio broadcast on Jazz FM. Other users include an independent record label owned by Yugoslavian guitarist Zoc Zoran, who used the OM system on a recent CD release of music by jazz musician Jim Lampe. OM is currently being evaluated by a major broadcaster and remastering guru Tony Arnold. It has also recently been used on a new album by David Cross, the ex-violin player from King Crimson. Richard Bryce, director of Perfect Pitch Music, stresses that the major advantage of OM is both its revolutionary electronics and its time to market, which has enabled it to be produced at a fraction of the price of its Canadian and Japanese competition. Because of our background in psychology as well as electronics, we were able to draw on the existing literature of audiology and perception and sidestep a great deal of unnecessary fundamental research undertaken by our competitors. Coupled with novel electronic circuit techniques, this has meant OM can be produced for a fraction of the price of Q-Sound or the Roland RSS system. We aim to put the technology within the reach of ordinary studios and modest production budgets. It costs £3,500 or is available for hire at £100 a day. So that's now the fourth of these new stereo 3D processors. The one they didn't mention is the Soundbase 3D, as used by Kiss FM in London.
A piece about the new Dolby Digital Stereo Sound System for cinemas. Dolby has stated that practical tests on its SRD, digital film sound format, have proved successful. Dolby SRD optically records 6 channels of digital audio in a digital control data track in the currently unused area between the sprocket holes on 35mm film. This leaves the part of the film occupied by the analog soundtrack untouched. Only a single version of each film, containing both soundtracks, is required, with the cinema selecting to replay either the digital or analog sound. Single inventory prints are a significant cost saving, and therefore more attractive to the film industry. In the winter, specially prepared SRD prints of Star Trek VI ran at 3 theatres in different parts of the US. Dolby equipped the theatres with prototype DA10 digital decoders and film readers, as well as a computer system to monitor performance from Dolby headquarters in San Francisco. The systems settled down well, and all prints had run more than 200 times with no reported audio deterioration. According to Dolby spokesman, they are now completing the groundwork for the print duplication systems. Dolby did not monitor audience response during the SRD tests, being more concerned with durability, but film companies may have been. It appears the advantage a digital soundtrack offers as a marketing tool are encouraging competition for the first SRD release. According to Dolby, this could be in June or July this year. Keith Spencer Allen, writing in Pro Sound News Europe. We'll be right back.
Now here's one you'll all recognise, the Stone Roses and Fool's Gold. Woo! It says here, it's spring break at Daytona Beach, Florida, and the MTV Roadshow has got the students kicking up a sandstorm in the afternoon heat. 1,000 beer-sodden bull-necked jocks in surf shorts and Ray-Bans, and girls wearing sneakers with their string bikinis get down to the shuffling sound of sunny Manchester circa 1990. How could it happen? College radio is how. College radio is the reason these kids, against the odds, look out for the next single by one-hit wonders such as the Soup Dragons. Why St. Etienne, a band largely ignored in their homeland, knocked Michael Jackson off the Billboard dance chart in January. And why every American student you meet seems to know all three of Teenage Fan Club's chords off by heart. In the USA, around 20% of high school graduates go on to higher education, compared with 4% in the UK. That's hundreds of thousands of kids with time to party on their hands. A vast, affluent music market, which is the envy of Europe's record companies. For any band trying to make it in the USA, the simple three-point plan for self-promotion is touring, press, and getting on college radio. REM and the Pixies owe their impressive crossover status from scratchy indie bands to front-of-store superstars not to the power of music television, but to the most discerning element of the student population, the DJs. Now you can tell Princeton University in New York takes its radio station seriously. The 20-foot aluminium mast is mounted on a mock Gothic tower in the town's high street. An old established Ivy Leaguer, WPRB, is odd in that its frequency 103.3 remains in the centre of the FM dial, despite a ruling by the hawkish FCC that non-commercial stations must keep to the left-hand end below 92 FM. The theory is that listeners cluster around certain areas of the dial, and so it makes sense to keep the big money makers away from the supposed small fry. Not that the money matters more than music to the students who run things down here. Down in the basement studio, the crucial decisions about what records to play are constantly being made. While a Sonic Youth track crackles away in the background, DJ Sean Murphy takes a call. WPRB, Jesus Jones, I don't think we'll be able to get that one for you. Bye. He hangs up. We try not to play the sort of thing you would hear on a classic rock station. I tend to play cutting-edge stuff here, like Geek, Bullet LaVolta, Slovenly, The Galloping Coroners. Our signal goes from Newark to Delaware. That's a potential audience of 10 million people. But it's not like we're having that deep, booming radio voice. We play what we want, and try never to mention the college. Like, these people don't give a shit about what's happening at Princeton University, they just want music. Resplendent in a wedding present t-shirt, John Solomon, age 18, major TV/radio/film, sorts through the new releases in a spare studio with his colleague Arthur Fenno, philosophy. Their opinions are being courted by the major record labels. Yeah, they send us stuff. Beer, third base, sent us ale and t-shirts. Hats are pretty big at the moment. I remember Frank sent out promotional tampons with her name on. They'd be more interested if we played their major label schlock all the time, though, says Arthur. Most of the stuff they have is completely worthless. Not only do they call you up repeatedly to ask you to play the record and find out you're not playing it, which 99% of the time we're not, they also want to know why. Half the time I get the sense they just haven't even listened to it themselves. They have this list that says Public Image Limited, REM, U2, Nirvana, whatever it is. And they'll send you about 15 copies in the hope that you'll eventually play it. Like Nirvana, they're on every chart, now even the dance chart. I'd rather give another band a chance, like Fugazi, Superchunk or Scrawl. One that doesn't have a fully-fledged publicity arsenal behind it. Any good college station is run on the rocket fuel of enthusiasm and steered by the fine movements of fashion, so choosing records is difficult, and each DJ, once he has passed the written test or comp that most places insist on, stands or falls by his own taste. Choice cuts from the Kill Rock Stars compilation or pipe-rattling noises by XX Section on Extreme Records of Victoria, Australia can really make a show swing, but it's important to cultivate the basement monotone for those pedantic back announcements. Anything but end up sounding like one of those cheery Light FM stations that are springing up all over the country. College isn't just an alternative rock school, however. Up in Massachusetts, Harvard station WHRB 95.3 FM might have a weak signal and some heavy subsidies, but the scramble to be a compa is frantic at the start of the semester. The standard pattern is jazz and classical during the day, everything else in the evening, but the rap house and swing beat show on WHRB is particularly good. In fact, the two original DJs went off to New York after graduating and formed The Source, a national magazine known as the Black Rolling Stone. When they were here, the show was called The Darker Side, says DJ Judy Chen. Then it got changed to alternative R&B because some people thought it was racist. Now it's street beat. It reaches out to the community, but not always with the desired effect. Once we had a rap group in the studio with some of their friends, and someone dissed another posse on air, so this posse and their friends came down to the building with baseball bats and started beating everyone up. The university authorities weren't very happy about that. Generally, though, the university authorities are happy to the point of indulgence. The station occupies the basement of an old round building in the centre of the campus and has several studios. One large room is dedicated to the 10,000 album record library, the sleeves furry from use. There are CDs everywhere, along with the usual detritus of student all-nighters, junk food, paper cups, an old mattress. As well as alternative R&B, Harvard specialises in the orgy, a tradition it claims to have started. It all happened with this guy who just sat all his exams and was really happy. He came down here and played 9 hours of Beethoven. The orgy, or period of total indulgence, is now a college radio ritual at many stations. A bulletin board at Harvard is covered with letters from fans who appreciated a band beyond description, the Grateful Dead orgy in January. 6 days of dead recordings interrupted only once by a basketball report. Naturally, they also had a Robert Schumann orgy, a Henry Purcell, the entire oeuvre in strict chronological order, a Dizzy Gillespie jazz organ orgy, even a cowboy hat orgy devoted to any new country artist, Garth Brooks, Clint Black, Alan Jackson, etc. WHRB are not allowed to make a profit and consequently only sell as many car ads and pizza jingles as they can be bothered to. But across town in the most civilized part of Boston is Emerson College, a FAME-type school of the performing arts, where they operate all aspects of WERS 88.9 FM very professionally. It has 200 students working on it, including 43 DJs. The station reaches 3 million people across 5 states, and the whole outfit makes British local radio look extremely low rent. Program director Jeannie Lombardo, who has a taste for heavy metal, explained why the station is rated so highly in the city. College radio is pretty much a free-for-all. Each station can really play what it wants. For instance, in New York, there's a Catholic school which broadcasts heavy metal 6 days a week, then church services all day Sunday. We don't really have pirate radio in the States. There was a little station round here recently, really low power, only about 3 or 5 watts, just some kids doing it out of their basement for fun. You probably couldn't have heard it outside a few backyards, but after a tip-off, the FCC went in and shut them right down. Boston has a reputation as the hub of the alternative rock scene in America. It produced the Pixies, Extreme, Lemonheads, Bullet the LaVolta, Blake Babies, music that flourishes on this type of radio. The current college funds our main expenses, but we raise around $60,000 a year by having live bands into the studio and getting people to pledge money over the phone. We have a live music week when we have over 100 bands coming through these doors in 7 days. They come for the exposure, and because the students are more into the music than normal industry folk, it's a party, and they know they won't be getting a shitty acoustic set and getting interviewed by some guy reading questions off a piece of paper who's never heard their records. Commercial stations copy our shows and pick up on what we're playing, and record companies definitely give their bands more money for a video or whatever if they see them doing well in the college chart. The perfect example of that is Nirvana. As you approach New York City, the babble on the radio increases, threatening to choke your scanning tuner. Spanish house, wild gospel shows, live from church, rabbinical phone-ins. Yet it's still a surprise to come across a station as left field as WFMU 91.1 FM, run out of an old Victorian house in Uppsala College, East Orange, New Jersey. The voice of a small, Lutheran-based liberal arts college with 1,000 students doesn't exactly recommend itself until you actually turn on and tune in, which is when you're likely to hear Neil Young, Miles Davis and John Zorn back-to-back. A Rossini overture, all a cheap, low-fidelity home recording by a WFMU listener, a Beatles records, genre of music that other radio stations have never heard of, space-age bachelor pad, wacky European, sci-fi opera, songs of visionary madmen, a concert ticket giveaway in which listeners must correctly identify a mystery religion based on clues, a cartoon soundtrack, 70s disco, Japanese garage bands, Polish reggae, Mexican rockabilly, surf jazz, a story improvised in dialect followed by Eric Saiti, The Monkees, stuff by percussionist Spike Jones, a weekly Torah analysis. Like an extreme version of John Peel, they raised the flag of freeform programming in the late 60s, and it has flown ever since. The station of choice for New York hipsters, musician types and artists, WFMU was voted Rolling Stone Critics' Best Radio Station in 1991 and 92. As station manager Bill Suggs explained, the success has a lot to do with the students. We get no funding from Uppsala itself. We're funded entirely by listener pledges. The target for 1992, $250,000. Some of the DJs have been here for years. They might come in from Manhattan or Brooklyn. Their tastes are known, and it's entirely up to them what they play. We risk alienating people, but so what? College radio is mostly a factory outlet for the record companies. It's where they test their alternative stuff. I mean, look at the Nirvana thing. It's that band again, Nirvana. The name of the noisy Seattle threesome, who were snapped up by Geffen Records, has become the latest mantra for success in the music business. Nirvana show what can be achieved on occasions when, in the absence of a hip national press, the college system functions as a network and everyone suddenly likes the same thing at the same time. The reason Nevermind shot to number one over Christmas was you got thousands of students who'd heard it every day on school radio for a whole semester going home for the holiday, so they all went out and bought it, which made everyone else want it too. Rival stations are campaigning to halve WFMU's wattage, which is based on an error in their original contract about how many feet above sea level their transmitter could be. To fund its legal battle, WFMU is raising money, not just by the usual irritating on-air panhandling, but by organising an art auction at the groovy German's Van Eck Gallery, with a little help from folk like Cindy Sherman, William Defoe, Laurie Anderson, Allen Ginsberg, Jim LaMusch, et al. With friends like that, the odd bit of alienation in the industry is no hindrance, it's a fashion statement. So next time you're faced with the choice between some erratic pirate station or the Mike Smashes of this world, you can recall that in the United States there's a middle ground, and it works. That report in The Independent, Joseph Gallivan visiting America and hearing rock go to college. Well, in Britain, there is the beginnings of such a thing, and if the government was to give FM licenses to the student radio stations in this country so they could be heard outside a few blocks around their stations, then the enthusiasm is here in this country to make that work. Over to the Radio Authority.
recently round at some friend's house, and they had just received a very strange letter proposing a way around the scrambling on Sky Movies. This is what the letter said.
Dear satellite dish owner, says the photocopied document, do you watch the satellite film channels? Our interesting new document explains how many viewers are watching Sky Movies, the movie channel, and the comedy channel on their official Sky decoders without paying. This is possible also with inbuilt decoders, such as the Amstrad 400. No technical knowledge is needed, and no extra costs incurred. Detailed also is where spare decoders and viewing cards are being obtained by those without existing decoders. If you would like to receive your copy of this informative document, then please forward a cheque or postal order for £15. A postal order ensures a speedy response as it can be cleared straight away. This price includes postage. As you may imagine, it is difficult for us to advertise this document, so may we ask you to be kind enough to forward this letter onto a friend or neighbour who also has a dish. Thank you. Cheques payable to S. McFarland, Harlequin Services, Gothic House, Barker Gate, Nottingham, NG1 1JU. Sorry, strictly no callers. And then below it, there's a detach and return order form for you to send your £15 cheque or postal order. For the document, the hole in the system. An alleged means whereby some people can watch the coded scrambled Sky Movies and Movie Channel and Comedy Channel without paying.
Well, that's what the letter says. It was addressed to friends who actually do have a satellite dish. They don't know how their address was obtained. And the letter had a postmark of Northampton. So does anybody know who this is, what he's selling, and is it a complete rip-off? We suspect one reply you might receive if you send the £15 is that there are several thousand people who are Sky dealers who get complimentary cards from the Sky organisation, and they can watch Sky Movies without having to pay. It seems unlikely that for £15 you're going to be told a non-technical way to get round the scrambling.
No, it reminds me of recent adverts that were saying how to save money and not pay any money on telephone bills. And you sent off for this document, and it went through in great detail how you wrote to British Telecom and asked for your phone to be cut off, and that way you would pay no money in telephone bills. Yes, a letter now from Skopelos. It's a postcard from William Shimin. Greetings from Skopelos on the Sporades group of islands, about 1600 miles from the Irish Republic. Using my Sony SW1, together with what's laughingly described as its compact antenna, actually a reel of thin wire, I've been able to receive radio fax on 12255 just this morning at around 7 o'clock UTC. Caught an item on Sparks about single chip PC. Other listening here includes Luxy belting in at 15350 with the relay of the English language Astra service. William Shimin, who's presumably on holiday in Skopelos, one of the Greek islands, thanks for the postcard. And a few days later, William sends a letter from Much Wenlock in Shropshire. I'm writing this on my Scion Series 3 Palm Top in Skopelos, which is a small island in the Greek Sporades group. You may have received my postcard, if not his repeat of the information. Yep, right through there. Incidentally, on the subject of satellite, how about a feature on Sparks about choosing a system? I'm sure you have all the answers for those of us who are still dithering. I'm particularly interested in the audio subcarriers. What should I buy? A fixed or steerable dish? What features are worthwhile in the receiver? That sort of thing. Well, I'm not exactly an expert, perhaps someone listening in would like to do some sort of report recommending satellite dishes. Many thanks for broadcasting my Caroline and Mi Amigo recordings on 13th and 14th of May. It sounds daft, but I found it quite exciting to hear them on air. I guess it was the thought of shortwave enthusiasts worldwide being able to hear them. I'll have to send you some more. A bit more about me. I'm 44 years old and work as a computer trainer in Telford in Shropshire. I listen to Radio Fax usually on my Sony ICF-760D with an AN1 active antenna. Reception isn't that wonderful as there's an awful source of electrical interference in my vicinity, which I haven't been able to track down. I listen on 6205 in the daytime, but 3910 is usually better in the evenings. Occasionally 12255 is audible here. I guess that really I'm an anorak at heart, though I'm loath to admit it. I still get excited about offshore projects, despite their outcome often being disappointing. I live in hope that Caroline will wake up and, in whatever format, from whatever platform, will provide something new like it did in the early days. One last thing, while I would like a shortwave receiver for my car, and the Philips DC777 sounds very attractive, I couldn't bear to give up my excellent Pioneer RDS system. What I really need is a small digitally tuned shortwave tuner with an FM modulator, which could sit between the antenna and my existing receiver. If you could find one, surely one of the Taiwanese suppliers like Sangyan might have something like this in their range. I suspect there would be a significant market. Interesting idea. That's enough waffle. Thanks again for Radio Fax and keep it up. Thanks for the letter, William Shimin. This week on Sparks, we visit the Amberley Chalk Pit Industrial Museum in Sussex. A review of the last Free Radio Quarterly, how planners allocate space on the FM band, a look at American college radio, Britain's bosses discover corporate television, more about digital cinema sound, and complaints about cricket on Radio 3. So in Radio World magazine, engineers plan for UK expansion by our friend Lawrence Hallett. Radio engineers in the UK UK had their work cut out for them planning for the first national commercial radio service, expected to go on air later this year. The first station will broadcast on the FM band and will be required to reach at least 85% of the population within 2 years. Planners made several assumptions when laying out the FM service. That the minimum acceptable field strength is 54 dB microvolts per metre. That receiving aerials are placed 10 metres above ground level. That directional aerials are used for stereo reception. That non-directional aerials are used for mono reception. In addition, some of which obviously do not apply in practice, no formal account is taken of reception on portable or car radios. The field strength limit of 54 dB microvolts per meter provides sufficient signal for stereo reception with a directional rooftop aerial. By coincidence, this is also usually adequate for mono reception on reasonable modern indoor portables, and stereo reception on the more expensive types of car receivers. The UK planning standards are based on CCIR recommendations, but they differ in certain important aspects. In particular, the recommendations suggest that different field strengths should be used according to the type of area being covered. Because of the clutter caused by buildings, particularly in city centres, a figure of 75 dB microvolts per metre is suggested for urban areas and of 66 dB microvolts per metre for suburban areas. The signal strength upon which most UK planning is based is only considered appropriate for rural coverage, according to CCIR, although where planning considerations allow increases for different urban environments, they're provided by the radio authority. One big problem with the parameters used to define FM coverage is that although reception may be theoretically perfectly acceptable at 10 metres above ground level, increased multipath signal lower down can, and often do, cause unacceptable distortion and fading on portable and car radios. Increased transmitter power is not a complete solution, but it can help in some cases. So for a given transmitter power, just how far can the signal be expected to go? Well, for 10 watts, the effective antenna height of 75 metres, 8 miles is a rough limit, and for a 300 metre aerial, it's 17 miles. For a kilowatt, 75 metre area gets you 22 miles, and a 300 metre mast gets you 43 miles. And for 100 kilowatts, you get 54 miles for a 75 metre antenna and 86 miles for a 300 metre antenna. So it takes 100 times the power to double the coverage distance. Interference occurs when an unwanted signal adversely affects a wanted signal. It's dependent on three basic factors: the field strength of the unwanted signal, the field strength of the wanted signal, and frequency separation. Field strength is a function of transmitted power and distance. UK planning tries to limit fringe area reception of services by interference from other transmitters operating on the same frequency. Because the impact area of a transmission is greater than its service area, where the signal strength is deemed acceptable for public reception, there will still be a mush area of confused signals between the two service areas. By placing transmitters close enough to ensure that their coverage is limited by interference, the optimum use of spectrum is achieved. To protect adequate reception, where the wanted signal is just at its minimum, acceptable level of 54 dB microvolts per meter, unwanted signals must be 36 dB weaker for mono reception and 45 dB weaker for stereo reception. Even with this level of protection, multipath interference, where the wanted signal is locally weaker than expected and the unwanted signal stronger, can lead to reception problems within the expected service area of a given transmitter, caused by the presence of signals from its distant counterpart. CCR planning standards are based upon various assumptions about receiver design. However, an estimated 75% of all radios do not meet the criteria laid down within the CCIR guidelines. According to the CCIR, an unwanted signal 400 kHz removed can be 20 dB stronger than the wanted signal. According to other research, however, to ensure that 75% of radios can cope with rejecting it, the unwanted signal 400 kHz removed must be at least 5 dB weaker than the wanted signal. Receiver manufacturers should perhaps improve their standards over this issue, particularly as a recent German paper suggests that 300 kHz channel spacing should become the norm, in the interests of spectral efficiency. Strong signals from nearby transmitters cause a number of problems with broadcast receivers. They can be desensitized or deafened, making it difficult to pick up wanted signals, even if they're theoretically strong enough. Non-linear effects in the receiver can cause distortion and unwanted noises as the receiver takes off. Receiver-generated intermodulation products occur, making signals appear on the band where they didn't really exist, and superimposing one station on top of another. Where transmitters are located close to each other, intermodulation products of a different nature can be caused. These unwanted signals are, unlike receiver intermodulation products, real. That is, that they are actually broadcast by one or more transmitters and can be measured on a spectrum analyzer. For example, if a transmitter broadcasting on 100 MHz is located near another broadcasting on 102 MHz, signals could be created on a number of other frequencies caused by odd order products. These include 98 MHz, 104 MHz, 96 MHz and 106 MHz. Obviously, more transmitters in close proximity to each other create more spurii to be generated. They can occur elsewhere in the spectrum, and particular care has to be taken to minimise their presence where aircraft and emergency service communications are operating. Obviously, transmitter designers and engineers go to great lengths to ensure that spurious emissions are reduced to an absolute minimum, but with high-power installations sometimes radiating hundreds of kilowatts, there is usually still some signal in the immediate vicinity which can be enough to block the reception of distant broadcasts. In addition to intermodulation products, transmitters can produce wide-band phase noise and other discrete carrier products. This being the case, with few exceptions such as the Sutton Coalfield site in Birmingham, high-power transmission sites are located away from densely populated areas to reduce reception problems. According to a study by the European Broadcast Union, using a lattice network of transmitters carrying the same program material would require 2.5 MHz for 90% area coverage and 3.1 MHz for 100% coverage. By working towards population coverage instead of absolute area coverage, the BBC manages to reach 98% of the population using 2.2 MHz of spectrum. And there's a table giving the law of diminishing returns, showing it's progressively more complex and expensive to achieve greater population reach. With one transmitter, you can cover 24% of the population. With two transmitters, you can get 48%. With three, you get 59%. Seven gives you 79%. 14 gives you 90%. And here you see it's 72 for 95%. And then to get 98% coverage, you need 135 transmitters. Lawrence Hallett, writing in Radio World.
The enormous fuss about BBC Radio 3 having to carry cricket instead of music for several days during this summer has caused the managing director of BBC Radio, David Hatch, to be hauled into the feedback studio. Various suggestions were put to him by listeners, such as carrying the service of cricket news on just the AM channels of Radio 1 or Radio 4 networks.
Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, they haven't yet got Radio 4 FM. So if you actually use the frequency for the cricket, they will be deprived of Radio 4.
What proportion of listeners is that?
Well, you're talking about millions.
You see, you're saying, again, it simply
vast
cannot
sections
be done.
Of the populace have not yet got Radio 4 FM.
All right, if you can't split either Radio 5 or Radio 4, what do you say to the idea sent in by John Austin of Kenilworth?
Radio 1 has two channels, FM and medium wave. Surely this service wouldn't be unduly restricted if one of these were to be given over to cricket. At least the programmes would be available on one frequency or another, which is not now the case for Radio 3 listeners.
Well, I'm afraid the answer is the same again. You have to have both FM and the medium wave at the moment on Radio 1 to serve the nation, because only 3 years ago, Radio 1 had no FM at all, and we are still building the chain. So we're still less than 90% for Radio 1 on FM. Therefore, if you take one away, 10% of the Radio 1 audience, which is a vast audience, would be disenfranchised for the very small audience of Test Match Special.
So even though, in Radio 1's case, it is... I mean, 10% is not a huge amount.
10% of a large number is a lot of people.
Because it's so big, it is a great...
It's a lot more people than listening to you.
And is it a lot more people who, for example, would listen to Test Match Special?
Yes, oh, considerably more.
So you'll be...
And Radio 1 is an audience in millions. I mean, it depends what you're prepared to do. No commercial operator would think of sacrificing a vast audience for a small audience. And it would be clearly idiotic to throw away our Radio 1 audience.
So you're saying you're driven by logic, going through each of the possible networks to the point where you have to, in fact, put it on Radio 3. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying I think there is another option, which people put to me, which is to say, well, if you've got a sports network, why the devil isn't it on Radio 5? And the answer to that is that if you put the cricket on Radio 5, then it can't be a sports network unless you interrupt the cricket. I mean, how are you going to have a sports channel that doesn't do the Olympics, or Wimbledon, or Nigel Mansell and the Grand Prix, or Nick Faldo at Wentworth?
But presumably the classical music lover would say, how can you possibly have a classical music channel that doesn't play any classical music?
Well, let's come then to that why then Radio 3 FM? It's the least worst option. It's not one I'm very happy with, but if I have lost two frequencies, and let's just remember this, that actually this is not the BBC's problem. This was caused by the Broadcasting Act, which requires us to surrender two frequencies to the Radio Authority for commercial operators to exist. So let's remember that.
That was stated last week, and we have had letters this week saying, that's all very well, but it's not really the government's problem. The government took the frequencies away, but they didn't tell you to put cricket on Radio 3.
No, they didn't, no. But let me tell you why I think Radio 3 is the least worst option. One, it doesn't reduce the overall number of listeners. It actually increases it. And more people are therefore actually getting value for money from their licence fee. Secondly, it saves £900,000 because serious music is expensive and cricket isn't, and Radio 3 has to make savings anyway. Three, Radio 3 has been Test Match Special's home for many, many years. And indeed, the cricket was in place before the third programme was extended into the daytime. So if it's actually going to be judged on historical territorial rights, I think the music lover ought to remember that Test Match Special got to the pole and raised its flag long before Beethoven and Brahms actually arrived. Then it should be borne in mind that the audience for Test Match Special is actually five times bigger than the Radio 3 audience at those times of day.
But again, we've had letters saying the trouble with that argument is it just presses you towards maximising figures anywhere. If you're going to say that you're doing it because it's a bigger audience, you might just as well run Radio 1 Pop and all five networks.
Just hang on.
I'm only quoting you the feedback listeners.
Okay. Although, of course, Radio 3's music coverage is reduced, it's reduced by about less than 300 hours, and we are still broadcasting 5,350 hours of classical music. The fact of the matter is that classical music is a minority activity, and there is no other way of putting it, it is, and yet I suggest that 5,350 hours, a complete network of its own, a channel that costs more than any other bar Radio 4, is still a vast commitment. The cultural life of this nation, and I believe rightly so. What I would say is that I would simply plead for tolerance. All interests have to be served, and minorities should be respectful of other minorities. And the cricket lover is a minority, and so is the classical music lover. And we are trying to serve both, and I think we are serving both. And that is, I think, the best solution we can make at the moment. If a better solution emerges, and none of the letters have given me the answer, we will clearly take that route, because I am unhappy that they lose some music. Of course I am.
David Hutch, Managing Director of BBC Radio. There's one last letter on the subject which I can't resist reading. It's from Brian Lee of Houghton.
The BBC has got itself into an unnecessary fix over Test Match Special stealing airtime from Radio 3. There's a very simple answer. BBC producers delight in inflicting background music on listeners at every opportunity. So, whenever there's all-day cricket, simply run the normal Radio 3 programmes as background music to the cricket commentary. Why should cricket fans get privileged treatment? Let them suffer like the rest of us. The ride of the Valkyries would go nicely with Botham when he's got his blood up.
Oh, what a wicked suggestion. Like this, you mean.
Here he is, Alderman. In, bowls to Botham. Botham drives his four runs. A marvellous stroke, that. Chappell went down on his knees. The small boys come. Here is Alderman, running away from us, bowling to Botham. He gets there. Botham swings this, gets four runs over the slopes.
Well, 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 it's all happened.
Lily in, bowling now to Botham. Outside the off stump, he hammers this square through the covers, forms a lovely shot. Forcing shot off the back foot, he went back, hit it beautifully.
To him and Botham. Swings up and it's four runs, it's four more, and he's 100.
Chris Dunkley there on feedback, talking earlier to Managing Director of BBC Radio, David Hatch.
This week, the latest, and indeed it looks like it's the last, issue of Free Radio Quarterly dropped through the letterbox. On the cover, there's a QSL card from Live Wire Radio featuring a cool DJ in his shades, holding a handful of singles and throwing them on the record decks. Adrian Cook says this will be the last issue of FRQ for the present. It's been an interesting experience putting FRQ together. However, after being involved in Free Radio for what feels like a very long 10 years, I've decided enough is enough. And it's continuing to be an excellent roundup of news and articles. There's something about us on the first pages looking for our licence and asking for listeners to write to their MPs. There's the report about the INR2 and also about our April Fool's stunt when Wee Guy Radio appeared on April the 1st, and an interview with Steve Conway. And Steve Midnight advocates a great medium wave pirate revival. And he says the prospect of a medium wave revival could bring the true free radio back into the limelight and create a more accessible alternative for your average listener. And then watch the domino effect. How do we go about this? If stations were to broadcast for a couple of hours, two or three times a year, and several stations follow you, you can see how a scene can be built up. Each station may be short on activity, but together the overall feeling would be much more. My whole interest in all this that is free radio might again surface. I'm sure there are many enthusiasts waiting to be found. This is 1992 and Joe Public is being sold incredibly short. At the moment, no stations, including myself, have plans to broadcast on medium wave. But once the ball starts to roll, who knows what might happen? Remember the 1970s, it could happen all over again. A brief look at Steve Midnight's article, and then the profile of Live Wire Radio. Then there's a useful article, how to build an aerial tuning unit in true Blue Peter style out of the insides of an old kitchen roll, something I've done in the past. The trouble is, for outside transmitting aerials, the kitchen roll tends to get a bit soggy and the whole thing collapses. But it's okay for receiving ATUs. There's the Anorak Almanac, looking through into the past of pirate radio. And then the completely comprehensive free radio directory with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pages of just about all the pirate stations that exist in Europe with frequencies and addresses. And there's a look at the various frequencies and a very silly famous last words from Adrian Cook, the editor of Free Radio Quarterly. I'm very sad to see this magazine going, because it's been by far the best in this area, and all I can do is appeal to Adrian Cook to keep it going. And if anyone else fancies helping with it and sending in some articles, then he might be persuaded to keep the thing going. So very short lifetime for Free Radio Quarterly, but maybe we can persuade Adrian Cook round if you write to him and object or ask him nicely. He's at P.O. Box 112, Crewe in Cheshire, CW27DS. And if you'd like this copy, number 3, then it's £1. Here's a letter from Ewan Cathcart, writing again from Aberdeen. A few weeks ago, I wrote in with a cutting from a newspaper which featured a community radio station in the area around Ben Nevis. I was pleased when you read this article out on air. I also said that I would hope to make further contributions at a later date. Well, here I am again with another cutting, this time from Dundee's Courier newspaper. The feature is on Fife's first community radio station, East Sound. It would be interesting to see how this station performs. Fife is already served by other local ILR stations. Forth RFM and Max AM from Edinburgh can already be heard in the intended service area for the new station, while those living in the northern area of Fife can receive Radio Tay from Dundee. I'm also interested in the choice of name for the station. There already exists in Scotland a North Sound and West Sound. Now we're to be joined by an East Sound. I wonder when we'll have a South Sound. Anyway, keep up the good work, and I'll write to you again if I spot any more interesting articles. Thanks, Ewan. So Glen Rothes is to be the home of East Sound, Fife's first community radio station, providing it is granted the broadcasting franchise by the Radio Authority. A board spokesman confirmed yesterday that they have opted to create studios and offices on the Saltaire Park Industrial Estate. The other option was Randolph Industrial Estate. "We've made our decision after weighing up the merits of both sites," said Technical Director Norman Riley. "It was thought that we could set things up more quickly and effectively at the Glen Rothes premises. It could be that we may be able to get on the air by Christmas this year, although our primary target still remains the early part of 1993. The station will be using a transmitter probably located on East Lomond, capable of broadcasting to an adult population of around 260,000. Transmissions may reach the southern side of the River Forth, but the station's primary concern is to cover Kilcaldy district and other areas to the east, including Coupar and East Nuke. The station will need 7 full-time staff, plus a number of part-timers, and all profits will be ploughed back into the community." Thanks to Ewan Cathcart from Aberdeen for sending in that article, and if anyone else sees any interesting articles, then I'd like you to send them in. And, of course, they'll be read out. And also, if you've got any comments on the programmes generally, then please feel free to have a moan on, say what you think. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. And if you'd like a reply, then please enclose 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address, again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And I'd also like to have your listings of what you've heard around the shortwave, mediumwave and FM bands in your area. That'll all be to help with compiling the programme Sparks, which is our weekly technical look at news and features every Monday and Tuesday, presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook.
I still dream of organ home. I wake up crying, you're making rain, and you're just in reach. When you in sleep escape me, you're like my yo-yo, like a load in the dark. What made it special?
Here's Jonathan Miller in the Sunday Times. ITN switches on bespoke TV. Forget the Rolls and the company jet. Now Britain's bosses will have the chance to become personalities on their own TV stations. By phoning ITN, they can order up a bespoke satellite channel to speak to the world. ITN, which is seeking profitable new activities, has teamed up with Burson Marsteller, the international public relations consultancy, to provide big organisations with the ultimate in corporate status symbols, the company TV station. Corporate TV is a $200 million business in America, where more than 100 companies, including General Motors, regularly use TV to make financial presentations, announce new products, or give corporate pep talks. ITN and Burson believe the European market could be equally large and are already negotiating with Unilever, Ford, and IBM. The service will cost companies about £1,500 an hour for satellite time and a similar amount per year for each dish installed. Production costs are extra. Burson will handle marketing and ITN will make its production facilities available to ensure programming is to a professional standard. For an extra charge, executives who feel nervous about going before cameras will be trained. Dick Emery, the ITN executive seconded to the new venture, says few costs will be incurred until the business is operating and the costs will be covered by revenue. He is quick to add that customers will not be given preferential treatment on ITN's news programmes, which will be run entirely independently. Thorny MI is backing the Five TV Consortium, led by the Canadian entrepreneur Moses Znaimer, to run in its bid for the franchise to run Channel 5, writes Matthew Lynn. It has agreed to put its rentals division, which includes the Radio Rentals and Rumbelows retail chains, into the consortium. If the bid is successful, Thorny MI will have to retune some 3 million videos to stop interference from Channel 5 broadcasts. Thorny MI will not take any equity in the consortium, but will have a stake via its 58% holding in Thames TV, which has joined Sony Pictures as one of the main partners in the consortium. That's in the Sunday Times.